Welcome to our growth summary of The Little Book of Common Sense Investing by John C. Bogle. This book explains a simple investing strategy that can grow your money while minimizing risk. Instead of trying to pick winning stocks or funds, Bogle says we should invest in the entire stock market through low-cost index funds. It's an easier and lower risk way to grow your wealth over time, highly recommended by Warren Buffett and countless other experts. So, why should you read this book? Well, it's a classic that anyone can learn from, whether you're new to investing or experienced. It's easy to understand and it explains the stock market and investing clearly for beginners, but also with plenty of historical data to back up the points. So these are lessons I think they should teach in school, but don't, and it gave me more confidence in saving for the future. The author John C. Bogle is founder of the Vanguard Group and creator of the first index mutual fund. He made low-cost investing accessible to everyone. And then he wrote several influential books, including this one, and also Common Sense on Mutual Funds, which are now seen as basically must-reads for beginning investors. So let's jump right into our first theme, key takeaway number one: keep it simple with index funds. Instead of trying to beat the market, choose index funds, which are a simple, low-risk way to own the entire market. Today, many of the most popular finance books are champions of index funds. I'm thinking of books like The Psychology of Money, The Simple Path to Wealth, Tony Robbins' books like Unshakable, and many more you've probably heard of. But those authors owe a great debt to this one, John Bogle, who basically invented the whole idea of index funds, and he even created the first one through his company Vanguard. So let's jump right into what this book says. So starting with a summary of the introduction. So this introduction gives an overview of the book's core argument, showing how investing in a low-cost index funds is a simple and smart way to grow your money without taking big risks or too many risks. First point is about how index funds work. So an index fund lets you own a small piece of every company in the stock market. This way, you share in the market's overall growth, the company profits, and dividends, without the risks of picking individual stocks or the high fees of actively managed mutual funds. Next point is the power of compounding. Over time, even a small amount of money that you put into a stock index fund can grow a lot thanks to compounding. As an example, with a 7% annual return, each $1,000 that you invested 50 years ago could have grown to $30,000 today. And that's better than the vast majority of investors who try a lot of complicated strategies to try to beat the market. Next, we want to avoid Wall Street's high fees. This is another major theme in this book. Traditional mutual fund managers, which represent Wall Street, they make billions of dollars collectively from high fees and frequent trading. But all of that takes money out of your pocket and the average investor's pocket. You see, many actively managed mutual funds have a 2% expense ratio, and that simply means annual fees. Now, 2% doesn't sound like much, but when we compound it over years, those fees will take away a significant chunk of your wealth. So index funds keep costs low to you and eliminate so many of those unnecessary expenses. Final point is there's been a kind of index fund revolution. John Bogle created the first index mutual fund in 1976, and that started a movement that transformed investing. Assets in index funds have skyrocketed from $28 billion back then to $4.6 trillion today, proving this simple strategy really works. So now let's jump into chapter one, our summary of chapter one. So this one is all about a simple story which shows why most investors lose money when they try to beat the market instead of sticking to low-cost index funds. So the main point in this chapter is the story of Gottrocks. This is based on one of Warren Buffett's letters where he tells a similar story. So imagine there's a family called the Gottrocks that owns the entire stock market. And so every year, as the businesses in that market grow, this family earns all of that growth through their shares in the stock market. But then one day, helpers show up and convince some family members that they can make more money than others by picking specific stocks that will grow faster. So then some members of this family begin paying fees to these helpers, like in advisors and consultants, but that leads them to more frequent buying and selling of shares, which results in higher taxes and fees. So over time, all these fees and taxes cause the family's overall share of the market's growth to shrink from 100% to just 60% because of all these costs. But then a wise uncle steps in and says, stop paying all these fees and taxes to the helpers. Go back to the simple passive investing strategy that we had of owning and holding all the stocks in the world instead of paying all these fees and taxes to people. And so that's what they do. So this whole story illustrates a simple common sense idea, which is that as a group, investors can only earn the market's growth minus the fees and taxes they pay. So what that really means is that active investing strategies really benefit the financial intermediaries like stockbrokers and advisors, not investors collectively. When one investor makes a slightly higher return, that means another investor somewhere had to lose by that same amount by buying or selling at the wrong time. And so the whole point here is that most people would grow their money faster simply by avoiding all the costs that come from these financial intermediaries and sticking to buying and holding. And that really means owning an index fund if you want diversification. Okay, a final point in this chapter is that Harvard uses index funds. So it's a little social proof for the idea. Jack R. Meyer, who has tripled Harvard's endowment fund through his wise leadership of it, he says most investors mistakenly believe that they can pick fund managers who will beat the market. But instead, he recommends doing what Harvard does, investing in diversified, low-cost index funds. So here we have a workbook exercise. This is a little exercise you can use to reflect on the book, to apply its lessons, and to get some personalized, actionable guidance when you input your response on growth summary. We have a little AI coach built in. So here's the exercise. Write down one investment you currently own or are considering. What is its expense ratio? And if you don't know, you can type not sure. To give you an example, I use an automated investment service called Wealth Simple, which takes care of a lot of details for me, and I think it has 0.5% fees and mainly invests in index funds. Now, that one is specific to Canada, but I think there are very similar ones available in the US and other countries, such as Wealthfront. But anyway, let's jump into the second key theme or takeaway of this book. That's number two, focus on real growth. Index funds capture the steady, predictable growth of real businesses, avoiding the risks of speculative stock trading. When we think of investing, we often picture just stock prices as numbers and these green, red line charts going up or down. And we think if the number goes up, that's good. If it goes down, we might feel sad if we own the stock. But with that kind of abstract game approach to it, it's easy to forget that when we buy a stock or a fund, we're really buying a piece of a real business, which is made up of people, systems, buildings made of bricks and mortar. This insight can make us appreciate investing for what it is and approach it with a much healthier mindset that is more long-term. So jumping into summary of chapter 2, which breaks down the difference between real business growth and speculative stock trading, showing why it's smarter to focus on long-term predictable returns. So the first big point here is about investing versus speculating. The stock market has two parts to it. There's real business growth represented by profits, dividends, and other things. And the second part is speculative trading, which is really guessing where stock prices will go, trying to make money off that. So stock prices go up and down daily because of the traders' emotions and their predictions. But over decades, John Bogle says 95% of investor returns have come from real business growth, not that speculative game. So the takeaway here is that we should focus on the steady growth of businesses, because trying to guess which way the stocks will go tomorrow has made investors almost no money overall in the long span of decades. So real business growth comes from real increases in sales, profits, and innovation. Speculative swings in the price, on the other hand, they reflect investor emotions, like how much fear or excitement they're feeling right now. And those emotions affect the price-to-earnings ratio. That's a number that represents how much investors are willing to pay for $1 of company earnings. So during market booms, this price-to-earnings ratio can climb really high, like over 30 in the 1990s, but it always returns to realistic levels over time, typically around 20. Next point is regression to the mean. Business returns have been very steady over the past 100 years, averaging 9% annually and rarely turning negative, only during the Great Depression. Speculative returns, however, are very unpredictable and they swing wildly. After a bad decade where the speculation has returned negative numbers, the market usually bounces back strongly, and this is called regression to the mean. So it shows that speculation is not something we can reliably depend on as a way to grow wealth. So that brings us to chapter 3, which is all about how index funds capture the growth of real businesses, making them the easiest and most reliable way to grow your money. So as I'm sure you're getting the point by now, that index funds are the strategy of this book. This author considers them to be the winning strategy. So let's explain why. We now know that over time, stock market growth matches the growth of business earnings and dividends together. And so that means the best strategy is simply to own a piece of all the businesses in the market, and we can do that through index funds. For example, $15,000 invested in the Vanguard 500 index fund when it was opened in 1976 would have grown to a very impressive $913,000 today. Now, with a note of caution that past success does not guarantee the same results in the future. The next point in this chapter is to keep it simple. Most complex strategies, like picking the best fund managers or using algorithms, they simply don't work when we look at the results. In fact, 96% of actively managed mutual funds fail to beat the market after taxes are considered. That's according to Yale's David Swensen. There's a principle called Occam's razor from science that says the simplest solution is usually the correct one, and it's usually the best. And that's true for investing too. So let's talk about the types of stock market indexes they are. So an index is simply every stock in a certain market or a group of the market. So the first main type is called the S&P 500. That index tracks the 500 largest U.S. companies by market size. That's called market cap. And the S&P 500 represents 85% of the U.S. stock market. For example, Apple makes up 3.2% of the S&P 500. That's the size of it compared to the total stock index. So it makes up 3.2% of any index fund that is based on the S&P 500. Now, the second type is called a total stock market fund, and that includes a wider range of 3,000 and more companies. Now, that performs nearly identically to an S&P 500 index fund with a 99% match in returns. So both are excellent options for capturing the market's growth. Now, I'm going to connect this to another book. There's a recent best-selling book called The Psychology of Money, where the author Morgan Housel emphasizes the point that chasing higher than average returns is a fool's game, because almost everyone who tries to do it ends up making less than the stock market's average return. And at the same time, they're taking on a lot more risk. Paraphrasing Warren Buffett, that author tells us, "There is no reason to risk what you have and need for what you don't have and don't need." So you can learn more like that in our summary of The Psychology of Money by Morgan Housel. So that brings us to the next big theme, key takeaway number 3 of this book, which is the cost advantage. Minimizing fees, taxes, and expenses is the most reliable way to maximize your long-term returns. So there's an old sports cliche that offense wins games, but defense wins championships. When it comes to investing, so many of us focus almost exclusively on playing offense, which is on how to make it grow faster. But we too often neglect the defense part, which is about how to avoid others taking our hard-earned money away from us, often through costs. Yet it's that second part of the equation that can make an even greater difference to our wealth over time. So that brings us to chapter 4. This one is all about why keeping costs low is crucial for your success in the stock market. So the first point is that costs eat your wealth. Actively managed mutual funds charge 2 to 3% per year through expense ratios, sales charges, and other trading fees. These costs directly reduce your returns, which is why most investors have underperformed the market. You see, while the stock market has averaged 9.5% annual returns over the last 100 years, the average investor in that market has only earned 4.5% after subtracting 2% fees and 3% inflation. And this is often due to the compounding effect of costs. You've probably heard of the compounding effect when it comes to growing our money through compound interest. However, just like your returns compound over time, the costs that you pay can also add up and compound over the years. So a 2% annual fee may sound small, but over 20 years, 30 years, 50 years, it has a huge impact. As an example, $10,000 invested at 7% grows to $294,000, but when we subtract 2% fees, then at 5% growth, it would only grow to $114,000. So to repeat, $10,000 before fees grows to almost $300,000. After fees, it's just over $100,000. So where does that missing 60% of the growth go to? Well, it goes to the financial intermediaries who take the 2%. Even though you invested the money, took all the risks, and provided the money up front. And that brings us to chapter 5, which explains why choosing a low-cost fund is smarter than relying on looking at a mutual fund's past performance. So it's about why low costs trump past performance. So the main point here is that past performance doesn't predict the future in investing in a mutual fund. So many people pick a mutual fund based on the past success that it had, but that doesn't mean it will do well in the future. In fact, a stronger predictor of getting higher returns from a fund is simply choosing funds that have lower costs. What we should beware of is survivorship bias. Mutual funds often seem to be better than they are because about 25% of them disappear over time, usually due to poor performance. And that makes the surviving funds look more successful than they are on average because we're not looking at 25% of them that don't even exist anymore for us to look at. And a final point to drive home the advantage of low-cost funds. So in the author's analysis over 25 years, the lowest cost funds averaged a 9.4% return compared to 8.3% for the highest cost funds. This difference is mostly accounted for by the difference in fees between the two. And while that may seem small, it adds up. So the low cost funds would grow your money 8 times over 25 years, while the highest cost ones would only grow it by 6 times. Now, index funds with fees as low as 0.1% let you keep almost all of the market's returns. Next, we have Chapter 6, which explains why dividends are so important for growing your wealth over time and how low-cost index funds multiply their impact. So, dividends are payments that companies give to shareholders, usually as a portion of their profits. They're a steady source of income for investors, and they have accounted for 4.2% of the S&P 500's annual returns on average. They're also very reliable, dropping only during major crises like the Great Depression and the 2008 financial crash. A powerful part of any investing strategy is to reinvest these dividends back into your portfolio. So if you invested $10,000 in the S&P 500 in 1926 and reinvested the dividends, it would have grown to nearly $60 million today. But without that strategy of reinvesting dividends, it would have grown to less than $2 million, simply from the stock price increases alone. So the way we can maximize dividends is by keeping costs low. With the fees of mutual funds, they can eat up 60 to 100% of the money that we would earn from dividend income, especially during years and times when the yields are low. In contrast, index funds with fees as low as 0.1% take only a tiny portion, allowing you to benefit fully from the compounding returns of reinvesting dividends over time. Now, there's a point we haven't covered yet, which is why index funds are so cheap, and it's because they're mainly automated. Because there's no decisions to make, they simply hold a portion of each stock in the market. They don't have to pay managers to choose which stocks are in the fund. They also need to pay much less money for buying and selling shares because that happens more rarely. Now, I want to connect this book to another great personal finance book. That one is from almost 100 years ago, and it's called The Richest Man in Babylon. Now, unlike a lot of finance books, it's a very entertaining read, with wisdom about money hidden within these short stories set in the desert, with camels and gold and shepherds. So that book first coined the idea of paying yourself first, and that means to first put a part of every paycheck you earn into your own savings, and that's even before taking care of expenses and purchases. You see, when we pay everyone else first, and then we buy what we want, and then we say we'll save what's left over, then usually there's zero left over at the end of every paycheck. But when we pay ourselves first, and then live off what's left over, then we can often make it work. And in that way, we can grow our savings and grow wealthier over time. So you can read more about that in our summary of The Richest Man in Babylon. So that brings us to the next key takeaway, number 4, why most investors underperform. Most investors earn less than the market due to emotional decisions, high fees and taxes. So John Bogle doesn't have a very high opinion of the investment fund industries as a whole. He correctly believes they're primarily driven by the desire to make those selling the funds rich rather than being in the best interests of the investors who are their customers. So he spends a lot of time underscoring the downsides of an active investing strategy, including downsides we might not have thought of before. So that brings us to chapter 7, which explains why most investors do earn less than the market, which is caused by poor emotional investing decisions. So let's first talk about the gap between market and investor returns. Over the last 25 years, the S&P 500, the stock market, returned 9.1% annually, while equity mutual funds returned only 7.8%. Yet the average mutual fund investor earned even less than that, 6.3%. And after inflation, this gap can cut your potential future wealth by more than half over 25 years. So why do investors underperform the market itself by so much? John Bogle says a big factor is emotional decisions, driven by fear and greed, lead to bad timing and poor choices. You see, investors often buy when prices are rising, influenced by market hype or fund marketing, and that's usually right before a drop happens. And then they panic and sell while the prices are falling, and they later miss out on the eventual recovery too. As an example, during the dot-com bubble of 2000, investors poured money into high-tech stocks and funds focused on those internet companies, only to sell after the crash happened, and that doubled their losses because eventually a lot of those companies did recover, like Amazon. So the solution, in this author's eyes, is to stick to a simple low-cost index fund and hold it for the long term. This removes emotional decision-making, timing, and stock selection out of the equation, and that helps you outperform 85% of other investors who fall into those common traps. Index funds help you avoid reacting to market hype or fear, so you can stay disciplined and let your investments grow over time. Now, what does Chapter 8 say? It explains how taxes can quietly eat into your investment returns and how index funds can help you avoid that. So over time, taxes can take away tens or even hundreds of thousands of dollars from your returns. Actively managed mutual funds trade stocks a lot more often, holding them for an average of just 19 months. And every trade triggers taxes, adding up to about 1.2% in your annual costs. Now, index funds, on the other hand, trade very rarely. They try to hold stocks forever. And that results in much lower tax costs, usually less than 0.5% annually, and that's mostly from the dividends part of the earnings. So by minimizing taxes, index funds help you keep more of your returns and so are a smarter choice for long-term investing. Now let's look at Chapter 9, which is all about why future market returns will likely be lower than in the past, and so why low-cost index funds will become an even better way to protect your gains. So this author believes that future returns will be lower. Over the past 40 years, the S&P 500 has had unusually high returns of 11.7% per year, which is much higher than the long-term historical average. And so for this reason, John Bogle predicts future returns will be much lower, perhaps 4% for stocks and 3.1% for bonds. Some other reasons for these estimates: dividend yields are expected to stay low, around 2%. The price-to-earnings ratios will likely drop from a current high of around 30 to the historical average of 20, and interest rates for bonds will return to normal levels after being also unusually high in recent decades. So based on these predictions, a portfolio that contains 60% stocks and 40% bonds could be expected to return only 3.6% annually, which is not very much compared to what we've been conditioned to expect. And after we subtract 2% for inflation, the real return drops to just 1.6%. Now, for those people who are investing in actively managed mutual funds with fees perhaps of 1.5%, the net return could be as low as 0.1%. And that can sound really depressing to a lot of people. Now, index funds may be able to save us if these slow times are ahead. Low-cost index funds with fees as low as 0.1% allow us to keep a lot more of our returns. In a low return environment, which we may be heading into, this difference becomes even more critical. Wouldn't you rather keep 1.5% of growth instead of just 0.1%? So in a world of lower returns, avoiding those high costs becomes more important than ever, and this author says index funds are the smartest choice to maximize your gains. So here we have another workbook exercise. Think of a time you made a financial decision based on emotions, such as fear or hype. Write down what you learned from it in one sentence. Now our next big theme, key takeaway number 5, is avoid chasing winners. Short-term mutual fund success is often due to luck, not skill, and rarely lasts. Betting on a sports team may feel exciting, makes the game more engaging, and provides an emotional payoff, a big hit of dopamine if they win, which is why people do that. Now, in that situation, we are speculating who is going to win, trying to predict the future, which is always a risky thing to do. How do we try to predict which team will win a game? Perhaps we look at their past record to see how many games they've won in the past year. Now, many people take that kind of same approach towards investing, but as we're going to see, it's not that simple. That brings us to chapter 10, which explains why it's nearly impossible to pick mutual funds that consistently beat the market and why index funds become the smarter choice. So the first big point here is don't try to pick winning funds. Your chances of selecting a fund that consistently outperforms an index fund are only about 0.5%. Here's why. Over 46 years, 355 mutual funds were analyzed. The first thing to know is that 80% of those funds no longer exist. Most of them were closed due to poor performance. Of the remaining funds that have stuck around, almost all of them were within 1% of the S&P 500. So their success is likely due to luck. And there were only 2 funds out of 355 that outperformed the market by more than 2% over 46 years. And those 2 were Fidelity Magellan and Fidelity Contra Fund. Now, it gets a little worse too, because even the 2 winning funds have a disappointing story over the longer term. For example, the Magellan Fund, which was managed by Peter Lynch, it started small with $7 million in assets, and at first it outperformed the market by 10% annually during its early years. As its extraordinary success gained attention, billions of dollars poured into the fund, so that by 1999 it was managing $105 billion. But as this fund grew, its performance steeply declined. So it fell below the S&P 500 performance for the next 20 years. So that means most investors who joined the fund missed the golden years of outstanding performance and ended up having poor returns. So by 2016, the assets in this fund had dropped to just $16 billion. The lesson here being that index funds offer a more reliable way to invest without the risk of trying to pick a fund that beats the odds. That brings us to Chapter 11, which explains why a mutual fund's short-term success is usually random and doesn't last. So a lot of people look at the short-term success of a fund to choose which ones to invest in. But there's something called reversion to the mean, which explains why this is a bad idea. Funds that outperform in the short term often return to average or worse performance very soon later on. This phenomenon, called reversion to the mean, shows that exceptional results are usually just statistical flukes. And that means a few good years do not guarantee ongoing success. Instead, they're often followed by weaker performance. You see, many investors rely on Morningstar ratings as to pick which funds to go into. They look at the ones that have 4 or 5 star ratings from this service called Morningstar. However, these ratings focus heavily on the recent performance, with 35% of the score based on the last 2 years. A Wall Street Journal study found that after 10 years, only 14% of the 5-star funds in Morningstar kept their same rating, while more than half of those 5-star funds had dropped to 3 stars or lower. Final point is that investors are fooled by randomness. Top-performing funds often seem like winners because of their luck, not because of any skill from the managers. This is actually an idea from the author Nassim Taleb, who has a book named Fooled by Randomness. And he has an example like this. If you start with 10,000 fund managers and you flip coins for each of them to determine a winner, so by year 2, you have 5,000 winners and 5,000 losers. You flip the coin again, and now you have 2,500 winners, fund managers who have won 3 times in a row. So then by the end of year 5, you'll still have 313 winners, winning managers, that appear to have a perfect 5-year track record of winning coin flips. But it's not really a track record. They only won due to chance. So the point here is, if you start with a big enough pool in the beginning, then even after several years, you can still have hundreds of people who appear to have this great winning track record, even though they've just been lucky instead of skilled. So now let's move on to Chapter 12. This one explains why financial advisors often fail to choose better performing funds, but they can still be good for our financial guidance. So, it might seem logical to trust experts to outperform regular investors, but research proves otherwise. A Harvard Business School study found that funds chosen by professionals earned just 2.9% returns, compared to 6.6% for funds chosen by individual investors. Yet, 70% of people choose to invest through those intermediaries who seem to get much lower performance. So there's a conflict of interest that is very fundamental. Many stockbrokers earn commissions by selling certain funds, so they're often incentivized to push trendy but risky investments. For example, Merrill Lynch launched their Internet Strategies Fund during the 2000.com bubble. It was a hit product, selling $1.1 billion. But within 2 years, the investors in that fund had lost 80% of their money, and the fund was shut down. It was folded into another one. So while it was very successful for the company, it was a costly failure for their customers. Now, on a positive note, this author notes there's a growing trend towards fiduciary duty, which legally requires financial advisors and professionals to act in your best interest. So, what are financial advisors good for? While they can't reliably pick winning stocks or funds, they can assist with critical tasks like managing taxes, saving for retirement, and building a portfolio based on your risk level. To get the best advice, this author recommends looking for an advisor who recommends low-cost index funds as a core part of their strategy. So that brings us to the next key theme, number 6, start early to maximize compounding. The sooner you start investing, the more time your money has to multiply and grow exponentially through the power of compounding. So the Walton family controls 50% of Walmart, and they have 7 members of the family who are each billionaires. How is that possible? Well, from the beginning, Sam Walton, who was the founder of Walmart, assigned significant shares to his children and wife, saying that it's better to give away your assets before they appreciate. You can read more about his story in our summary of his book, which is called Sam Walton, Made in America. Now, while not all of us can have that kind of early advantage, it's always better to start sooner with our investing. As that old proverb goes, the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago, the second best time is today. So that brings us to chapter 13, which wraps up the case for index funds, highlighting how their low costs and simplicity make them the best choice for long-term investing. Researchers used a fancy tool called Monte Carlo simulation to compare an index fund with 0.25% fees to a mutual fund with 2% fees. So after 1 year, they found 29% of mutual funds would have outperformed the index fund. But over 50 years, only 2% of managed funds would have beat it. And that matches the real-world data we discussed before, where just 2 out of over 300 funds have consistently outperformed index funds. It shows the power of low costs over time to beat trying to perform better than the overall market. However, there's a caution that not all index funds are the same. They can have very different fees. For example, this author's company, Vanguard, charges no sales fees and has a low expense ratio of just 0.04%, while another fund from Wells Fargo charges a 5.5% sales fee and has a 0.8% expense ratio. And so that means if you invested $10,000 in the Wells Fargo index fund and your friend invested the same in the Vanguard low-cost fund, 33 years later, you would have $63,000 less due to the higher fees. So it turns out to become a significant difference. So next we have chapter 14, which is all about why bond index funds are also better than actively managed bond funds, and why bonds are an important part of any balanced portfolio. So why should we own bonds at all? As you probably know, bonds are loans you give to companies or governments that they pay you back with interest over time. Bonds generally have lower returns than stocks. It's been 5% annually over the last century and an estimated 3% for the next decade. But what they're helpful for is reducing risk and volatility. Bonds provide steadier returns, so they help balance your portfolio. That also means when the stock market drops by a lot, you're much less likely to panic and sell at the worst time. Now, bond index funds outperform actively managed bond funds mainly because they have lower fees, no high sales charges, and are more tax efficient. According to the SPIVA, which stands for the S&P Indices versus Active Report, bond index funds beat 85% of actively managed bond funds over 15 years, and the lower expense ratios explain most of that gap. Why do actively managed bond funds fail? Well, the main reason is that the bond yields or returns, they depend mostly on one thing, central bank interest rates. So managers can't do much to try to outperform the prevailing interest rate. Some of them may take on more risk by buying lower quality or junk bonds, but these strategies generally backfire down the road so it's better to avoid them. I want to mention a more recent book on index fund investing called The Simple Path to Wealth. When it comes to saving money for investing, here's a great tip from that one that I like. Here's a quote. Stop thinking about what your money can buy. Start thinking about what your money can earn. End quote. So you can read more like that in our summary of The Simple Path to Wealth on Growth Summary. So the next key takeaway is number 7, the downsides of ETFs. New index fund options like ETFs and smart beta ETFs may sound innovative, but they often encourage risky behaviors and overcomplicate investing. Now, over the last few years, we've heard a lot about new kinds of investing like Bitcoin, NFTs, and cryptocurrencies. Before AI took over, those were the hottest tech topics in the financial world. So in finance, there's always the cool new thing that promises to change the game, but most often it doesn't. While the new things talked about in this book are a lot less speculative than, say, Bitcoin, John Bogle cautions us to beware falling for hype and marketing. So that brings us to chapter 15, which explains what ETFs are, how they work, and why traditional index funds may be a better choice for most long-term investors. So, what are ETFs? ETFs, or exchange-traded funds, let you buy stock indexes throughout the trading day, just like you could buy an individual stock. So there are broad U.S. stock index ETFs, such as the SPDR 500 ETF or the Vanguard 500 ETF, and those can be great when used for long-term investing, and they're even sometimes slightly more tax-efficient than traditional index funds. But this author has a few cautions about ETFs. First, they can encourage bad behavior. Real-time trading can tempt investors to trade too often or try to time the market, strategies which usually lead to worse results. So for long-term investors using a buy-and-hold strategy, like this book recommends, real-time trading isn't really an advantage and can even be a disadvantage. Second caution, many ETFs focus on speculation. Only 32% of ETFs track broad stock indexes, so most of them will focus on specific sectors or strategies or countries, and that turns investing into something more like risky speculation. It goes against the principle of broad diversification and often leads to underperformance. And third, ETFs benefit the financial industry more than investors. Financial companies promote ETFs as a trendy product, which attracts a lot of investors who are enticed by chasing unrealistic returns. While ETFs now hold more than half the money that is in index funds, many investors misuse them. So this author believes traditional index funds are still better because they avoid the risks of frequent trading and speculation. They better reflect the core benefits of index investing, such as simplicity, diversification, and long-term reliability. So now let's go to chapter 16, which explains smart beta ETFs, a new type of index fund that claims to deliver higher returns, but often falls short. So what are smart beta ETFs? They're similar to traditional index funds, but they weigh stocks differently. Instead of using market cap or a company's total value to weigh how much of a stock to own, they focus on other factors, such as how much dividends a company pays out or other financial metrics. And they do that to try to outperform the market overall. They're marketed as an innovative and exciting way to invest. And as a result, smart beta ETFs have grown quickly to $750 billion in assets within 10 years. However, research shows that they don't really perform better. Looking at the first two smart beta ETFs available, they had risk-adjusted returns that were 97% identical to traditional index funds. So at best, they seem to mimic traditional index funds, but with higher costs. At worst, they're a form of active investing in disguise, pretending to be an index fund. Their biggest flaw, according to this author, is reversion to the mean. They pick a factor that has outperformed the market in the past, but that doesn't mean it will continue to do so. By contrast, traditional index funds will help you reliably capture the market's overall growth without adding any unnecessary complexity or risk. Next, we have chapter 17, which explores how Benjamin Franklin might have viewed index funds today. He was the father of value investing and Warren Buffett's primary mentor. So, who was Benjamin Graham in more detail? Benjamin Graham was a legendary money manager. He was author of The Intelligent Investor, and he pioneered value investing, where you analyze a company to find undervalued stocks. However, later in life, Graham questioned whether that approach he's known for was still effective because so much research was already being done, so perhaps it became much harder to find stocks that were undervalued by the market as a whole. He spent a lot of time later on criticizing Wall Street for focusing on earning commissions rather than helping investors succeed, noting that the market as a whole can't outperform itself. So, this author believes he would likely support index funds today. While Benjamin Graham lived before index funds existed, his key principles that he taught, such as diversification, avoiding high fees, and having realistic long-term expectations, they all align closely with index fund strategies. He believed most people, unless investing full-time, like a business, should take a defensive approach and aim for steady, reliable returns. Warren Buffett, a close collaborator of his, told John Bogle in 2006 that low-cost index funds are the best choice for most investors at home, and that Benjamin Graham would have shared this view as well. So let's move on to the next key theme or takeaway. Number 8, balance risk with bonds. Your mix of stocks and bonds should match your risk tolerance, age, and financial goals. So, to a complete beginner, investing may feel very risky and complicated, almost like gambling with your hard-earned money. Now, while there is risk always, it is manageable, and so much of investing is learning how to manage our money with the strategies to reduce risk, like adding more diversification, not trying to guess short-term stock price swings, and including more stable investments into the mix, such as bonds, so that way we could sleep better at night. So that brings us to chapter 18, which explains how we can decide our investment allocations, which means how to split your money between stocks and bonds, the two main types of assets. So Benjamin Graham believed that your asset allocation strategy, how much you put into stocks versus bonds, was the most important choice you'll make in investing. And a 1986 study backed that up. It found that asset allocation determined 94% of returns for institutional investors. So there's a simple rule of thumb, which is that we can start with 50-50 split of stocks and bonds. And if we want more growth, we can have 75% stocks, 25% bonds. And if we want more stability, go the other way, 25% stocks and 75% bonds. So including bonds into your portfolio will reduce your long-term growth, but it also protects your wealth during market downturns. As an example, instead of dropping by 40% during a market crash, your savings may only drop by 20%, and that can be a lot easier to stomach. It can protect us from making a bad emotionally driven market decision during a market correction or crash. So how can we decide how to split between these two main assets? Well, the two main factors are age and risk tolerance. Younger investors should often go for more growth, which means more stocks, while retirees will prioritize stability through bonds. The second factor is risk tolerance. And that depends on whether you can handle market drops without panicking And also, if you have any upcoming financial needs in the shorter term, like retirement coming soon, kids' college funds, etc. And next we have chapter 19, which explains more strategies for balancing investments, planning for retirement, and managing withdrawals. The first main point in this book is about target date funds, or TDFs. These funds automatically adjust your stock-to-bond ratio as you approach retirement, making them a very simple hands-off option. They're now the most popular choice, managing over $1 trillion in assets. This author recommends you always check that the target date fund you choose uses low-cost index funds within it. The next point of this book talks about popular types of retirement accounts. So first we have the 401k and traditional IRA. In these, contributions are tax deductible, but then you pay taxes on your withdrawals in retirement. And we have a newer choice also, which is the Roth IRA. This one is perhaps the better choice for new investors. With that one, you contribute your after-tax income, but then your money grows tax-free within the account, and you don't pay taxes when you're withdrawing the money in retirement. So let's talk about how much to withdraw when you retire. A good rule of thumb, this author says, is 4%. So dividends and bond interest from your portfolio, which are about 2% and 3%, those alone may not cover your expenses in retirement, so you'll likely need to sell some shares every year. So a good rule of thumb is that you can withdraw 4% of your portfolio each year. However, staying flexible is advised. During market downturns, it's better to withdraw less than 4% so you avoid selling a lot of your shares at low prices. And then during market uptimes, you can reinvest some of that additional growth into your portfolio. Next, we have chapter 20. The final chapter explains why index funds are based on timeless principles and why it's smart to start now, even with an uncertain future. So while the future is unpredictable, we can be sure of a few things, such as the long-term risk of not investing outweighs the short-term risks of market ups and downs. We can also be sure that investing early lets us benefit from the miracle of compounding, and also that keeping costs low allows you to maximize your returns. So while no one can reliably beat the market, index funds guarantee you a fair share of its growth each year. The second point in this chapter is the principles of index investing closely align with timeless wisdom, such as 300-year-old quotes from Benjamin Franklin. He said things like, "He that ventures nothing gains nothing," which can mean that you need to invest to grow your wealth. And he also said, "A small leak will sink a great ship," and that means to control your costs. Okay, we have a final workbook exercise here. Write down your age, and then to get a rough allocation of how much you should invest, you can subtract your age from 110, and that can give you an idea of how much you should have invested in stocks and the rest of it in bonds. As an example, if you're 40 years old, 110 minus 40 would equal 70, 70% stocks, and the rest 30% in bonds. Note that this is not investing advice, just a rule of thumb that this book and many others do note. So let's finish up with a few practical action steps. These are suggestions for how we could apply this book to our lives starting today. Number one, buy a low-cost index fund. Open an account and invest in a fund like the Vanguard S&P 500 with fees under 0.1%. Two, reinvest your dividends. Enable automatic reinvestment to grow your money faster through compounding. Three, cut costs immediately. Switch to a low-fee funds or platforms and avoid advisors charging more than 1%. 4. Set an investing schedule. Check your portfolio only monthly or quarterly to avoid emotional decisions. 5. Avoid chasing winning funds. Stick to a broad index fund instead of chasing short-term success stories or what is in the headlines today. 6. Start investing today. Contribute a set amount monthly, even if small, to build consistent habits. 7. Use ETFs wisely. Buy and hold broad ETFs like VTI and avoid trading or niche sector ETFs. 8. Balance risks with bonds. Adjust your stock-to-bond ratio based on your age. For example, 80-20 ratio for young investors of stocks versus bonds. 9. Automate your contributions. Set up recurring deposits to your investment account so you never miss saving. 10. Rebalance yearly. Adjust your portfolio to maintain your target stock-to-bond ratio. Now, if you're invested in a certain funds for retirement, that should happen automatically. That's all for this book, and I'll see you in the next one.